from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Greece's finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, has condemned its 240 billion euro bailout program. Speaking before the Greek parliament, he said it's not a feasible option and can't get the country out of the current economic crisis.
I want to tell you something simple. If this was about a bitter yet therapeutic pill which we were being pressured to swallow for our own good, I would recommend that we swallow it. If I believed that retreat and acceptance of the current bailout program, which as regards its logic and philosophy remains unchanged from 2010, would at some point, perhaps with some difficulty and pain, take Greece out of the crisis, I would recommend that we go ahead and submit without dogmatism and egotism. But I don't believe it.
After Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras outlined his plans to dismantle the country's austerity program over the weekend, financial markets in Greece slid further Monday as the new left-wing government pressed ahead with its agenda. Varoufakis said the crisis will not end if the country accepts another bailout program. Athens now faces a difficult situation, including possible ratings downgrade and a decision by the European Central Bank to no longer accept its bonds as collateral for financing. Meanwhile, Greece's top military official warned Tuesday that if the EU remains rigid on granting Athens a new deal, it will seek assistance elsewhere, with Russia and China among the possible candidates. The new Greek defense minister, Panos Kamenos, assumed office after the leftist Syriza party won last month's elections and Tsipras took over as prime minister. Kamenos said on Greek television early Tuesday, quote, "What we want is a deal. But if there is no deal, and if we see that Germany remains rigid and wants to blow apart Europe, then we have the obligation to go to Plan B. Plan B is to get funding from another source," closed quote. He added that it could be the United States, Russia, China, or other countries. The new Greek cabinet wants part of the national debt written off, a demand that Germany has rejected. Athens also opposes some of Brussels' policies, most notably the anti-Russian sanctions over the Ukrainian crisis, which has led to a painful trade war between Russia and Europe. In the wake of Syriza's victory, Moscow indicated that it would consider offering a loan to Greece. Greek Foreign Minister Nikos Katsias will visit Moscow Wednesday to meet his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, the Russian embassy in Athens reported Tuesday. Fighting still rages in eastern Ukraine on the eve of Wednesday's planned peace talks in Minsk. We have this from Press TV.
Ukrainian forces and pro-Russia militias in the east are claiming their turf as the world is struggling to calm down the situation. The Azov Battalion, a group of volunteers fighting alongside the Ukrainian forces, says it has taken several villages in the northeast of the strategic port of Mariupol in Donetsk region. Mariupol was a scene of fatal fighting last month when more than 20 civilians were killed in shelling. At the same time, the militias say they've surrounded Ukrainian forces in the strategic town of Debaltseve in the same region. Nine civilians and nine soldiers have been killed in fighting in the past 24 hours. Leaders of Germany, France, Russia, and Ukraine are expected to meet in Belarus on Wednesday. They'll discuss a new Franco-German peace initiative.
At least seven civilians were killed and 16 others wounded as the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk was shelled on Tuesday, according to local authorities. Those authorities said the shelling was carried out by Grad multiple rocket launchers and came from the direction of the town of Gorlovka, southeast of Kramatorsk. 10 Ukrainian servicemen stationed at Kramatorsk were also injured in the bombardment, according to the report. It was not immediately clear who was responsible for the attack, which took place at 12:30 p.m. local time, with Kiev's military and local self-defense forces each blaming the other for the incident. The creation of a demilitarized zone in southeast Ukraine and the start of a peace dialogue between Kiev and the rebels are at the top of the agenda for Wednesday's talks in the Belarusian capital. During the talks, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, Germany, and France are expected to insist that Russia take responsibility for the establishment of a demilitarized zone in southeast Ukraine, while Russia reportedly will argue that the OSCE should be responsible for the zone. The proposals were voiced by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande during talks with President Vladimir Putin in Moscow Friday. A permanent dialogue would begin, requiring representatives of Kiev and the People's Republics of Donetsk and Lugansk to meet every 2 or 3 weeks. The man who first lifted the lid on the CIA's torture program, John Kiriakou, was released from prison after spending 2.5 years there for passing classified information to journalists. The whistleblower spoke with RT Tuesday.
John Kiriakou worked for 14 years at the agency as an analyst and case officer. In 2007, he became the first CIA official publicly to confirm the agency's use of waterboarding. This is what Kiriakou told us 2 years ago about how he angered Washington.
When I went on ABC News in December 2007, and I said that not only was the CIA torturing prisoners, but that the torture policy was an official U.S. government policy that was approved by the President of the United States himself, the CIA filed what's called a crimes report against me the next day.
And in the very same year that Kiriakou spoke to us, he was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for passing classified information to journalists. Now he's out of jail but remains under house arrest, and he joins us from Arlington. Now, you've described your time in detention, and I quote here, I hope I'm not misquoting, terrible years that ruined you personally, yet you've also said that it's all been worth it. Can you expand on that?
I really do believe that it was worth it. I'm proud to have played a role, however small, in the outlawing of torture in the United States. And to me, the past now is water under the bridge. I'm proud to have played that role, and it's time to move on and continue this fight for human rights and civil liberties.
Well, let's just talk a bit about what you went through, if that's okay. You're currently writing a book about the conditions you encountered in prison. What were those conditions like for you?
I was surprised by the quality of medical care, the terrible quality of medical care, by the terrible quality of the food. American prisoners aren't even fed human grade food. I remember passing boxes, cases of food in the cafeteria marked not for human consumption, feed use only, or for sale only in China. And the medical care was even worse. There were almost a half a dozen deaths of prisoners while I was there in prison, and almost every one of those deaths was preventable.
What was your motivating factor in the first place to put yourself through this? You must have known that there was a high risk that you were taking on.
Well, no whistleblower really sets out to be a whistleblower. I saw a policy that I believed was not just wrong, but was criminal. And I decided to speak about it. I really didn't think long term about how the U.S. government can bring its full weight against a whistleblower. The goal really of the Justice Department is to ruin the whistleblower personally, professionally, and financially. I hadn't thought that through, and that's exactly what happened to me. But again, it's opened up a whole new world for me in the realm of human rights and civil liberties.
You say that the aim then is to ruin the whistleblower. Washington has officially admitted that torture took place. A comprehensive report has been released. Do you consider this a victory?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that I said was true, and we now know that because of the release of the torture report.
It's public knowledge then. Do you think the CIA will abandon its torture practices now that it's out there in the public domain?
I do believe that the CIA will abandon torture, not just because it's illegal, but because the truth always has a way of coming out. And I don't think the organization can withstand another revelation that they had yet again begun a torture regime.
I wondered how you feel, because the truth is out there, but no one as of yet has been held accountable.
That's right.
So, how do you feel about that?
It's the great irony, isn't it? I personally, I feel that the Justice Department is hypocritical to charge me for a crime, not just me, but other whistleblowers as well, Ed Snowden, Chelsea Manning, and others, and then to allow the torturers to go free. But what really bothers me is that there's no prosecution of CIA officers who obviously violated the law. Those CIA officers who were conducting interrogations in which prisoners were killed. I have no idea why there's no outrage and why those officers aren't being prosecuted.
And you talk about that and the conditions that detainees are enduring, for example, in Guantanamo Bay at the hands of the CIA, have become, I suppose, somewhat of a recruiting tool for jihadists. Do you think that these practices have actually done more harm than good in this war on terror?
I am absolutely positive that that has been the case. We always seem to step in a mud puddle, so to speak, where it comes to things like interrogations or drone strikes or attacks on individuals. These activities always serve to promote terrorist recruitments. And, you know, when we first began fighting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, we were talking about a core of just several hundred people. Well, now look at ISIS, which is sort of the next generation of al-Qaeda. We're talking about fighting something like 35,000 people. And I think that we've had a hand in that recruitment.
How do you think that the U.S. government's attitude to whistleblowers has changed? There's been a number of high-profile cases, including yours, over the last few years.
I think that Americans are more aware of the role of whistleblowers, whereas as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, nobody gave whistleblowers a second thought. I have to say, really, since I went to prison, that I've been overwhelmed by the support I've received from average Americans across the country. And I think that just a few years ago, that wouldn't have been the case.
Now, finally, after all that you've gone through, I have to ask you, would you go through it again?
I would.
Would you blow the whistle once more?
I would. I would do it again. As terrible as it's been, as difficult as it's been, I have a family that is rock solid in its support of me and a family that knows right from wrong. Torture is wrong. I'm proud to have played a role in the end of torture as U.S. government policy, and I would do it all again.
Negotiations between the United Steelworkers Union and Shell were set to resume Tuesday as the biggest oil refinery strike in the U.S. since 1980 expanded to two more plants Sunday. Negotiations between the union, representing about 30,000 oil refinery workers, and Royal Dutch Shell collapsed after Shell walked away from the table. At issue was the size of wage increases and worker safety issues. Strikes have been called at 11 plants, including 9 refineries, accounting for 13% of U.S. refining capacity. About 5,400 workers are now on the picket lines. The union said in a statement that U.S. refinery owners, led by Royal Dutch Shell, have failed to discuss health and safety issues and have engaged in bad faith bargaining. This includes the refusal to bargain over mandatory subjects, undue delays in providing information, and threats issued to workers for joining the strike. At the sites where workers have suspended their labor, companies have allegedly asked managers to scab or keep the plants running by doing the work normally reserved for union labor. Only one oil refinery has thus far opted to shut down because of the strike. The disenfranchisement of the citizens of Detroit and other largely black cities in Michigan has gone so well for corporate and banking interests who've snatched up public resources at rock-bottom prices that former emergency manager Kevin Orr was able to hire himself out to New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, Orr's next target, Atlantic City, the ailing gambling town whose residents are overwhelmingly non-white. Oceanfront property can be quite valuable once you chase the poor folks out of town. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
Kevin Orr, the black corporate lawyer dispatched by Michigan's Republican governor to preside over the bankruptcy and degradation of Detroit, has sold his urban executioner skills to Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey. Orr's next victim is Atlantic City, the town built around boardwalks and casinos, whose full-time residents, as in Detroit, are overwhelmingly non-white and poor. The immediate cause of Atlantic City's financial crisis is loss of its employment and tax base. 4 of the city's 12 big casinos have closed, putting more than 8,000 people out of work. Atlantic City's top elected officials oppose the imposition of an emergency manager, and no governor has ever tried to force bankruptcy on a city in New Jersey. But Detroit worked out so well for the bankers, it's now the textbook model for how to destroy any semblance of democracy in mostly black and brown cities. Kevin Orr proved in Detroit that it's always best to put a black man out front when your mission is to disenfranchise the residents of a chocolate city. Atlantic City Council President Frank Gilliam says Governor Christie is usurping the sovereignty of the community. But that, of course, is precisely the purpose of establishing an emergency manager dictatorship, to strip the targeted population of an effective vote and ultimately to push them out of town altogether. The state of New Jersey will probably never succeed in bringing Atlantic City's casinos back to their former profitability, just as Detroit can never relive its days as a world center of manufacturing. However, there are other potential uses for Atlantic City's seaside properties if only all those poor black and brown people could be cleared out of the way. If you can ethnically cleanse Detroit, a city of 700,000 people with an 82% black majority, then little Atlantic City, with only about 40,000 residents, 70% of them black and Latino, should be a piece of cake. Detroit is right now preparing to evict 100,000 people from their homes for being behind in taxes. That's 2.5 times the total population of Atlantic City. Detroit authorities have cut off running water to 40% of the city and are shutting the valves on 3,000 homes every week. The United Nations calls that a human rights violation, but it's not even an issue for the Democratic Party or for the first black president. Therefore, it's no wonder that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, a Republican presidential hopeful, is eager to replicate the Michigan model for black urban removal. Remember that Christie's political career took off when he put the black mayor of Newark on the road to prison back in 2008. If he can disenfranchise the voters in Newark, Jersey City, Camden, Trenton, and Paterson, just as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder did in all the largely black cities of his state, then Governor Christie will be hailed as a hero by every white racist in the country. And the Democrats won't do a damn thing to stop him, just like in Detroit. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The regional integration process in Latin America and the Caribbean has continued. Today we listen in on the program Interviews from Washington from Telesur. Host Jorge Gustoso speaks with Uruguayan Foreign Minister Luis Almagro on the subject of Latin American integration.
Our guest, the Foreign Minister of Uruguay, Luis Almagro. Mr. Foreign Minister, what is the situation of Uruguay regarding Haiti?
It's very clear. We have explained this in the past. For us, it's very relevant to follow the events in Haiti. We expect the situation there to be according to democratic rules, to have full guarantees of rights, political and civil. And so far, this situation is sustained on this basis. We can keep on our presence of troops there. If this situation changes, and we don't have any more these democratic conditions, then we definitely have to think about other possibilities regarding the presence of the troops. By now, what we have is the effort of the government in order to achieve democratic agreements with the opposition and to have transparent and clean elections. And for us, those are relevant matters, and we want to support this. So far, you know too that Uruguay, we have decreased the presence of troops in Haiti. Since we started in 2010 till now, we brought this troop from 1,200 soldiers to 250 soldiers, that is the last agreement. And with the idea of keeping our deals with UNASUR countries, and very likely to end our presence next year, according to this gradual withdrawal of troops.
Because there was sort of mixed messages. There was a moment that the future foreign minister was saying that Uruguay was on its way to withdraw overnight the blue helmets in Haiti. Is that true?
No. We have been coordinating, and this coordination has been very easy to do with Rodolfo.
Rodolfo Nin.
Rodolfo Nin Noboa, my successor. And Eleuterio Fernandez Huidobro, the Minister of Defense, that is the minister now, and he will go on as a minister in the next term. During this meeting, we have practically agreed in all the points, and what Rodolfo said is exactly what I have said now. If there are guarantees for democracy and fulfillment of all obligations under international rules of Haiti, in Haiti, then we definitely stay there according to these last agreements that we have with the United Nations.
Rodolfo Nin Noboa was even mentioning that was very close to be a dictatorship, Haiti. Was that his personal?
He said, no, what he said, and I don't like to explain other people's words, but I know what he said and what he meant, is that you have to follow the events closely. And if there were signs of a pre-dictatorship, then of course we should move our soldiers away. But that is very clear, and it's very consistent to what I have just said, that so far there are democratic guarantees in Haiti, we stay there. If these democratic guarantees suddenly disappear, then we move it away. It's very clear, and we have expressed this 3 years ago.
Regarding the OAS, the Organization of American States, OEA in Spanish, by the end of May, it finishes the second term of the current Secretary General, José Miguel Insulza. And there are pretty much strong indications, I will say, my words, that you could be having the necessary votes to be his successor. Are you ready to take over?
Yes, I was ready already when we presented
your candidacy.
My candidacy to fulfill that post. So far, we have developed a working plan, and we have had contacts with practically all the countries in the continent. These contacts have been permanent. We have picked up all the necessary changes and adjustments in our working plan according to priorities and suggestions of most of the countries of the continent. And we will keep working together with other countries till the election comes.
We have heard President Obama in the State of the Union address by the end of January mentioning not only that his intention to reestablish relations with Cuba, but also asking Congress to end up the blockade or the embargo, as they call it in English. So there's a new chapter in the relations between the U.S. and Cuba. If you are the next Secretary General of the OAS, what is your vision, your position regarding that new era, that new stage?
There is a new chapter in the continent, the hemisphere. Now we have a different relation also between the United States and the rest of the continent. And this agenda now suddenly is very positive, and we have many aims that we can take in the next period of the Organization of American States. To work the four pillars of the strategic vision of the Organization of American States, to develop an agenda for development in the continent, to bring closer the cooperation, international cooperation of a very developed country, the most developed country and the most powerful country in the world, with the continent in different terms, on different bases than what it used to be. And it's also a very good starting point to leave behind the Cold War. What the Organization of American States' main problem was, that was the last organization in this world to leave behind the Cold War and this remaining of these problems between the United States and Cuba was keeping the things in a very low profile of the relation and having a permanent problem there to understand each other between the Latin Americans and the United States. Now the United States has a different attitude and a different policy and a positive agenda regarding the situation in the continent. So we expect that under those new circumstances, we can develop this new cooperation agenda that is requested to bring more development in the agenda of the hemisphere, more equality, different conditions of cooperation, as I said, and different terms of political dialogue.
Because precisely regarding the OAS, in the years of the Cold War, President Fidel Castro was very strong in his statement, and he says the OAS is the minister of the colonies of the U.S. So do you think that with the end of that stage and the new reestablishment of relations between Cuba and the U.S., that could change?
Many things have happened since Fidel said that in the continent and in the integration of our countries. You know, it was a completely different view, and our countries have already voted to reincorporate Cuba to the Organization of American States. So also we can mention the creation of CELAC and the creation of UNASUR during these years. That brings different grades of cooperation between our countries than used to be, a different position of our country than they used to be in the 60s or the 70s during the dictatorships in the continent. Definitely we are thinking different and we are cooperating between us different. And all of our countries have reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba since long ago. They have long terms of cooperation with Cuba and a very solid friendship. So it's a completely different situation that we are, all our countries have been demanding the end of the embargo to Cuba, and we have been demanding the reestablishment of relations between Cuba and the United States. That moment arrived under completely different conditions. So far, the countries have changed. The Organization of American States is changing too, and have changed these necessary steps.
Talking about a different stage or different era, if you want, in our hemisphere, we're going to have, relatively shortly this year, a summit of the Americas in Panama. For the first time, Cuba is going to be participating together with the U.S. What can we expect? Can we expect Cubans and Americans shaking hands and coordinating visits in each other country?
Yes, we can expect many things. We can expect a lot of work between them. They still have to do many things in order to fully reestablish the relations in all different fields. And that is what they have to do. Now what we can do is to praise the courage of President Obama and President Raul Castro in order to bring the two countries together and to pass a page that was very dark in the continent. Now they have to start working in order to reestablish all the different grounds for cooperation between them.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.